And now it is my pleasure to introduce Robert Clara. Mr. Clara is an editor and writer. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the New York Daily News, American Heritage, New Jersey Monthly, and the Christian Science Monitor. Robert Clara has been a staff editor for numerous magazines, including Town and Country and Architecture, and has also worked as a researcher for legendary author Gay Talese. He lives in New York City, and tonight we're very happy he made the ride upriver to be with us. Robert?
Good evening. It's so wonderful to see so many people out here. Thank you very much for coming. Before I get started on the talk that I prepared, I thought it would probably be a good idea to confront the one question that is probably most integral when we're discussing the topic of this train. It gets right to the heart of the matter, and I figured since a lot of people will probably ask me anyway, I should just get it over with now, which is, why am I wearing bedroom slippers? These aren't just any bedroom slippers. These are actually called Albert slippers, and it was this very type of slipper that I have on, made by a firm in London called Shipton & Henage, that Winston Churchill wore. I found a picture of him wearing, well, not these slippers, but he had his own initials on his. I saw a picture of him wearing his slippers aboard the private train of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And seeing as I tried my best to bring you the whole train tonight, but it just didn't work out, I figured I'd bring you a prop. And warning, there's going to be another one, but that comes later. So what I figured I'd do tonight is talk a little bit about the presidential train itself, since it was the presidential train that became the funeral train. I'll talk to you a bit about the difficulties in moving this train, the great distance that it traveled, and then we'll wind up with a little bit of talk about the train's trip here in the Hudson Valley, since obviously that's something that I hope will resonate with many of you. I have two short excerpts that I'd like to read this evening. A really big shoe. First of all, the presidential train. Moving the president, moving Roosevelt, moving any president, was not an easy thing. And in FDR's case, that difficulty went well beyond the fact that he was obviously confined to a wheelchair. The reason for this is that when a president goes somewhere, of course, he doesn't go by himself. Moving the president essentially means moving the White House. And so when a president wanted to take a trip, provisions needed to be made for his assistants and the press and his advisors, and often upwards of 100 people. And back in the 30s and 40s, when Roosevelt was president, the way to do that, of course, was with a train. Most people were still taking the train at that time. And so the presidential train was a specific train that was put together just for FDR. It usually ranged between 9 cars and 11. The sleepers were taken off and put on as needed. Generally, there were two locomotives up front because the train was extraordinarily heavy, and I'll tell you why in a moment. And then following locomotives, you had a boxcar, and then a special modified boxcar that was actually big enough to carry the presidential limousines aboard it. The limousines would drive right up onto the train so they could drive FDR around, because remember, for most of his appearances, as you see in photographs, he remained seated. Then, after that, you had a string of Pullmans. Usually, the press corps traveling with Roosevelt would be on a Pullman. His assistants and secretaries, what have you. Pullman car, I should specify what that means. It doesn't look like Metro North. The pity, right? the cars were what rail fans know as heavyweight cars, and they weren't kidding. The cars weighed 80 tons apiece. They were dark green. My gosh, they looked like battleships, but inside they were like rolling hotel suites. They were very beautifully appointed with wool rugs and very large staterooms. Many of them had lounge areas aboard where there were couches that you could sink into and little wooden tables to play cards on. It was really quite a lovely way to travel. And so those were the Pullmans that were on board. And then, of course, you had a dining car because most of these trips were overnight. Some of the Roosevelt's trips could last 2 weeks and more. And then, as we near the end of the train, and this is kind of counterintuitive about trains, because these days, you know, when you fly someplace and, of course, you're in coach, which means you're in the back, and they make you walk past all those people that can afford first class, and it's, like, really annoying because they're up front. A train was just the opposite. In a train, the further back you were, the more prestigious you were. And there was a reason for that. The reason was a steam locomotive, which would belch smoke that would basically inundate the first several cars of the train, which is why those were always baggage cars. And so the rear of the train was very much the penthouse of the train, if you will. So as you move toward the rear of the presidential train, people become gradually more important. The second to the last car in the presidential train was usually a Pullman called the Connaught. And that was the car that the Secret Service rode on. It was a self-sufficient car. It had a kitchen on board and bedrooms and a lounge area. And the lounge area was not so the men could lounge. The lounge area was in place largely because it had huge observation windows on either side. And this was why the Secret Service chose this car. The large windows were very, very useful for keeping an eye on either side of the train and keeping an eye on the rear car of the train, which is where Roosevelt was. So it was entirely a security procedure. And of course, anyone who wanted to pass into Roosevelt's car would have to go through the Secret Service car first. So now we come to the last car on the train, and that car was a wondrous piece of equipment called the Ferdinand Magellan. The Ferdinand Magellan was what was called in those days a business car, which is sort of like the equivalent to today's Gulfstream II jet. If Bill Gates were riding around in the 40s, this is the sort of car that he would have. It would be usually lavishly appointed with carved wood and frosted glass sconces on the walls, and the Ferdinand Magellan was no exception. It was an absolutely baronial car, which lasted in service to Roosevelt just fine until Pearl Harbor. And then at that point, the Secret Service decided that having the president ride around in an ordinary Pullman car would not do. And so the Ferdinand Magellan was hauled back to Chicago, and it was completely dismantled. And then at that point, the gentleman from the Pullman factory put 5/8-inch thick steel plating all over the car. They took the windows out and they replaced them with bulletproof glass windows. They were 3 inches thick. The door to the car opened only from the inside, and it was so heavy it usually took the largest staffer his bulk just to pull the thing open. This car could withstand machine gun fire. It was armored from beneath, so it could also withstand an explosion on the tracks if there was one. The marketing people at Pullman said that the car was strong enough to withstand a fall from a 100-foot railroad trestle. The marketing folks at Pullman were silent about what would happen to its occupants. So by the time the Ferdinand Magellan was finished with its armoring, and remember I said the average Pullman car is 80 tons, when the Ferdinand Magellan rolled out ready for a wartime FDR, the car weighed 142 tons. It was the heaviest railroad car ever built, and it still is. The car is currently down in Miami at the Gold Coast Railway Railroad Museum, and if you're ever down there, please go visit it. I gave them a little bit of a donation because they let me use some photographs, so they tell me that some of the upholstery is, well, I paid for some of the upholstery, so if you see a tuft with my name on it, please send me an email. So anyway, this entire presidential train had a name, and it's a rather inelegant name. Its name was POTUS, which kind of sounds like a character from The Simpsons you never met, but POTUS stood for something. It was an acronym. POTUS stood for President of the United States. And now, to most people's ears, that meant nothing. It was just a funny name. However, when it came time for Roosevelt to go someplace, and a gentleman by the name of Dewey Long, who was the White House transportation man, picked up the phone and placed a call to the railroads that had the tracks that the presidential train would be traveling on, and he said the word POTUS, it essentially meant move. And that is exactly what happened. And the railroad's entire system, in many cases, would literally come to a halt with the mention of that name. The railroad would be told in advance when the train was coming. At that point, hundreds of railroad employees would fan out. Each of them had a job to do. The track gangs would start walking the route that the train would travel, and I mean walking every single foot of it. They would check every switch and turnout along the route and lock and tighten bolts as they went to make sure that nothing went wrong. They were also looking for things that looked fishy. For example, an empty car parked a little bit too close to the tracks would be towed away. Undercover policemen would fan out to the stations along the route, and much like you'd see in film noir, they would hide behind broadsheet newspapers, and you know, you'd see the brim of fedoras peeking up over the top, looking for suspicious characters. I kept seeing that suspicious characters. I'm not really sure. I mean, I live in New York, so I don't know how you identify one of those. So then the train was ready to go, and before it left, a locomotive, a single locomotive, sometimes an entire train that was entirely empty, except for the engineer and the fireman, would take off in advance of the presidential train. It would take off about and leave about a mile's distance between it and the presidential train. The idea being that if anybody wanted to try something funny, they would mistake the first train for the presidential train. And so an explosion would befall the decoy train or the decoy engine. Meanwhile, the last minute preparations to the presidential train would include, among other things, Secret Service tasting every little bit of food that would be stocked aboard the kitchen that would be feeding meals to Roosevelt along the way. There was even a special grade of coal that had to be inspected and loaded onto the tenders before it could be burned in the locomotives. And then finally was where the train left from, which is kind of remarkable, and I really wanted to get to see this, but the folks at the Treasury Department aren't really keen on visitors. There was a secret platform in the sub-basement of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. It was a freight spur that was normally used to take delivery of the things you need to make money with, you know, ink and paper and what have you. Well, the presidential train would be parked down there. And so when Roosevelt went someplace, and if you've read my book, you know this is how it opens. The presidential motorcade leaves the White House, drives a few blocks to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, makes a quick left, and they would load Roosevelt onto the train there. There was actually a very tiny lift that was installed in the vestibule of the Ferdinand Magellan that was just big enough for Roosevelt in his wheelchair, so it would literally elevate him to the level of the car. And so this was the train that was down in Georgia on the 12th of April, 1945, when Roosevelt died. The train's last trip with a living FDR aboard was on March 29th. The train left the secret platform, headed south to Warm Springs, Georgia. It arrived on March 30th. After they dropped Roosevelt off, the train would turn around, and it would go up to Atlanta, and they would keep it there on a secret, well, maybe not so secret, but out-of-the-way siding at the North Avenue Yards in Atlanta. And there it would sit, and the standing orders were that the train had to be ready to leave within minutes of a telephone call. So it would be left fully stocked, and it would not have a complete staff on it, but there were two gentlemen that remained with the train 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there was always a way to get this train to where Roosevelt needed to go within minutes. But Roosevelt expected to spend several weeks down in Warm Springs, and the reason was that he was a very sick man. He had just returned from a summit at Yalta, and when he returned, his staff, I remember reading that Grace Tully burst into tears when she saw him. He was fading very quickly at that point. Most people who saw Roosevelt knew that obviously something was wrong. They could tell just by looking. He was frail and haggard. His skin was ashen. But only a handful of people knew what was truly wrong with him. And there has been some speculation as to Roosevelt's various maladies toward the end of his life. What I do know is this. Several months prior to his death, his cardiologist wrapped a blood pressure cuff around his arm and came away with a reading of 260 over 150. So those of you out there that happen to have hypertension, take your medication. Because unfortunately in 1945 there was no medication for hypertension. And so Roosevelt's cardiologist wrote that about all that the president could do was wait for what he termed a pop. And what that pop was a hemorrhage. And a cerebral hemorrhage is exactly what happened to FDR on April 12th. At that point, the story starts to get very complicated and it starts to move very quickly. Because Roosevelt had made it known to many people that he wanted to be buried up here in Hyde Park. Now, while no one is entirely sure where FDR believed he might be when he died, it was probably not 1,050 miles from where he wanted to be buried. So suddenly, his staffers and the White House Transportation Office back in Washington were faced with an absolutely monumental problem. Not only did they have to get a train ready to carry his casket, but they had to find a way to get that train an incredible distance and get it there safely. And so down at Warm Springs, a gentleman named William Hassett, who was the functioning press secretary, the acting press secretary down there, picked up the phone, and he made a telephone call to the North Avenue Yards in Atlanta, and he said, POTUS needs to be down here by tomorrow morning. And so immediately they started to get that train ready, and it left within, you know, an hour or so. It was the second call, though, that Hassett made that really starts this story moving in a new direction. And that call went to a gentleman by the name of Fred Patterson. And Fred Patterson was a very prominent funeral director down in Atlanta. He catered to the moneyed and, well, I don't want to say titled, but it is the South, so it's pretty close, the titled families of Atlanta. And Patterson was sitting at home smoking a cigar, reading the paper, and the phone rang and said, President Roosevelt is dead and we need you right away. What Patterson did over the next several hours would become part of history, and it would become a major part of my book. First, Patterson summoned his men, and they got into two different hearses, each with a different casket in the back, and they drove two hearses down to Warm Springs. It was about 80 miles to the south of Atlanta. They wanted to give Eleanor Roosevelt a choice of caskets. The one that was selected, by the way, was a solid copper casket, very difficult to come by in wartime with the metal shortage. It had a bronze finish. So many of the newspapers said it was bronze, but in fact it was copper. Patterson's men got to work on Roosevelt's remains shortly after they arrived, and sparing you details that are needlessly graphic, they had a very, very difficult time. Roosevelt's heart disease was so advanced and his arteries were so calcified that it was actually difficult to get the preservative fluids through him, and it took them close to 5 hours to embalm him. So he left several of his men in the cottage at Warm Springs to do that. And then at that point, Fred Patterson took a walk out to the depot down in Warm Springs, where at that point, the train had been brought down from Atlanta, and it was parked. So remember what I said before about the order of the cars. You had the Ferdinand Magellan at the end, and then the Connaught one up from there, the Secret Service car. Patterson had been told, a reasonable enough plan, that the coffin was going to be put aboard the Ferdinand Magellan for the trip north. It was a fitting thing. It was FDR's car, after all. But when Patterson went to look at the car, he realized that there was a very, very serious problem with the plan. And the plan was that nobody had apparently owned one of these things. The door was too narrow for Roosevelt's coffin. It would not fit aboard the car. So then he thought, well, we'll just remove a window. But when the windows are 3-inch thick plate glass, that's not an easy thing. And so it became apparent to him immediately that the plans that had been made were simply impossible to execute. At that point, I think any normal person probably would have fled the scene. But Patterson was a man of great foresight, and he took a walk up to the length of the train, and he passed the canot, and he looked at those huge observation windows in the lounge, and then he summoned some men nearby, and he said, "Take that window out." And so what happened, though, at that point, was that the trainmen had to switch the last two cars of the train right down there. So the Connaught was put at the end of the train, and then the Ferdinand Magellan was the next up, because obviously they wanted the last car of the train to be the one that would contain FDR's remains. Patterson did not stop there, though. He did something that is going to call for this evening's second prop. Patterson, on the spot, got a paper and a pencil, and he began to draw. And he summoned the carpenter down at the Warm Springs Foundation, actually got him up out of bed, and said, "I need you, and I need you to build a bier, because we need something to put the coffin on top of." Nobody had thought of this. And so Patterson specified that a wooden bier be constructed that was exactly 20 inches tall, which is where you see the first piece of red tape, okay, on my ruler. So now imagine the floor of the canot. Okay, so the beer comes roughly up to where my knee is. Now, Patterson had calculations in mind as he was doing this, because he also knew how tall the casket was. The casket was 24 3/4 inches tall. And so when you put those two numbers together, you get 3 feet 9 inches, which is where my second piece of tape is. Okay? So, if you were one of the honor guards standing aboard the Connaught, and there were four of them that would stand at each corner of Roosevelt's flag-draped casket, you would see that the lid of the coffin comes more or less up to where my sternum is. Okay? Now, here's the important thing. The windowsill of the Connaught was roughly, say, where my pocket is, all right? Which means that if you folks there were watching me on a train passing you, and you look through the window, you would be able to see what? About 1.5 feet worth of flag-draped casket. And that tiny bit of foresight, but incredible bit of foresight, was what enabled tens of thousands of Americans who came to stand along the route of the funeral train to look through the window of the car and see that coffin. It was Patterson's foresight that created a memory in the minds of thousands of Americans, and it would be a memory that they would take with them for the rest of their lives. And Patterson was prescient, because, in fact, thousands and thousands of Americans did turn out along the route. In the book, I termed this the longest church pew in America, and it probably was. People came from unbelievable distances just so they could stand at the edge of the tracks and wait for this train to pass them. Remember, there was no television at the time, and you did have radio at home, but people did not have a way to express mourning in public, and not everybody could get to Washington. In fact, not everybody could get to the railroad tracks. There was gasoline rationing in effect, and so people would gang up their tickets and pile up into cars and drive, and many of them simply walked, and they found the tracks that the train would be traveling on, and some of them stood all night waiting for the train to pass. And when the train did pass, the men would slip their hats off their heads, and women cried, and much of this resulted in incredibly moving scenes that were covered by the newspapers. This was not just a moving trip, though, and I mean moving in terms of emotion. It was also a very dangerous trip, and here's why. By the time the funeral train reached Washington, D.C., it would become a very different train. It was an 11-car train on the way up there. They added one extra sleeper in Atlanta. But Everybody in Washington, D.C. wanted to go to the burial here at Hyde Park. And when I say everyone, I mean even people who had railed against FDR for the entire time that he was president. Men who did not, who couldn't stand him, suddenly wanted a seat on his funeral train. Whether they wanted to be part of history or whether they wanted to do some gland-having with Harry Truman, anybody's guess. But what happened was the funeral train of 11 cars had to be lengthened to 18 cars once it reached Washington, and still there were so many people that wanted to ride on it that they had to add a second train. And so the story is sometimes confusing because there were really two funeral trains that moved between Washington and Hyde Park here. But for these purposes, when I say funeral train, I mean the main one, which is the one that had all the important people on it. It had the Roosevelt family, or at least the ones who could make it, because some of the boys were in the Pacific. Elliot Roosevelt was able to make the funeral. Truman and his wife and daughter, the Supreme Court, most of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the leaders of the House and Senate, in effect, the most important people of the government, clamored aboard this train so they could be part of this. As a result, the Secret Service decided that many, many measures would be necessary to protect the train, and probably the most visible of those measures was that they managed to get enough soldiers to stand along the entire route. And that was over 300 miles between Washington, D.C. and here. And so if you can imagine something like this, a soldier, say, standing where I'm standing, and then another one standing, oh, say, in the middle of the stage, maybe only 12 feet away, and then one 12 feet from him, and from him, and from him, on both sides of the track for over 300 miles. So I want to read you a short excerpt here about what this meant from a security point of view. Looking back on the event from a time in which terrorism on domestic shores is no longer theoretical, the very idea of what took place on the 14th and 15th days of April 1945 borders on the ludicrous. The new president and his cabinet, the most senior and influential members of Congress, the nine robes of the high judicial bench, and the highest-ranking officers of the armed forces, in sum, the entire leadership of the free world, elected to board a single train and take a trip together. It was an excursion that took them through some of the most densely populated urban centers of the United States, along a route that had been announced in advance, and it all happened during the largest global conflict in recorded history. It is difficult to imagine any occasion of state today, joyous or tragic, that could galvanize so many men and women of varying callings and opposing views and bring them together for such a visible, spectacular, and altogether dangerous undertaking. Even in 1945, the thing felt momentous. Quote, in the history of the American government, noted Thomas Reynolds of the Chicago Sun, there probably never before were so many top-ranking officials of the government in one single place. Whether in deference to the dead president or for fear of planting ideas in the minds of subversives, few remarked publicly about how the funeral train, profound and historic a mourning ritual as it was, represented an unprecedented imperilment to public safety, to the national security, at a time the country could least afford to play games with fate. Hindsight, however, would loosen lips. Writing 27 years after she rode aboard the Roald Amundsen, that was Truman's private Pullman, by the way, as the comely young daughter of the new president, Margaret Truman reflected, quote, in retrospect, it seems a terribly dangerous thing to have done in time of war. If sabotage or an accident had wrecked that train, the nation would have been crippled. The train ride was a security undertaking of a size and scope never before attempted on American soil, a martial lockdown of 328 miles of railroad track, some 30 of which snaked through New York City, whose population exceeded 7.2 million. It would involve everyone from plainclothes detectives to armed infantrymen. It would also amount to one of the darker ironies in the shadow world of government. The Secret Service, whose sole purpose was to maintain the well-being of a live president, now faced the biggest challenge of its existence over a dead one. So let's talk about the Hudson Valley. The train went through New York City very, very early in the morning. It had left Washington, D.C. at 11 p.m. It was supposed to leave at 10, but it was an hour late. The reason it was an hour late is because when the engine started pulling the train had been so dangerously overloaded, and the Ferdinand Magellan was so heavy that one of the couplers broke apart, and they had to repair it, and then it broke apart two more times before they could finally get this train moving. And so it came through New York City as planned, entering Penn Station at 4:15 in the morning. And part of the plan, of course, was that, well, maybe they'll all be sleeping. It was part of the security calculus that if they brought the train through at a very late hour, it certainly would cut down on the crowds. They didn't want to discourage people from mourning. But they had the entire U.S. government aboard a train, and that was the primary consideration, was getting them up here safely. By 6:45, the train left the Bronx. And then it hugged the shoreline by the Harlem River, and then it made that turn by Spuyten Duyvil. And by the way, if any of this sounds familiar to Metro North commuters, it's no accident. This is the Hudson Division now. And the remarkable thing was that in the Bronx, for those people who woke up early enough that morning, they looked out their window. If they lived anywhere near the Mothaven Railroad yards where the engines were switched, they put this enormous Hudson-class steam locomotive, which is on the cover of the book. That's where they coupled it on, down in the Bronx. Soldiers were pacing the streets with machine guns, and they were pointing them around, and most people had never seen anything like that. You had to go to wartime Europe to see something like that, but you could see it in the Bronx on that morning. And so the train slowly made its way, and when I say slowly, I mean that. The train only went 25 miles an hour. It did that largely as a show of respect for Roosevelt, but it also did it for very practical reasons. With so many people that had turned out for a glimpse of this casket, Eleanor Roosevelt considered it a sign of disrespect if the train were to have gone too fast. And so at one point she had dispatched a request to the engineers, please keep it slow. And so the train made its way up the Hudson not too long after the sun had come up. So that was 64 miles or so of distance. It took quite a while at 25 miles an hour to cover that distance. And the sun came up and it broke across the river water. And if you can imagine this sort of thing, the Supreme Court justices getting up and wandering down to the dining car for breakfast and sitting there over their hash and eggs and coffee and looking out the window at this beautiful river and the sun breaking across the water and these beautiful undulating cliffs and mountains on the other side. Many people on the train had not seen the Hudson Valley before, and this was their first time. Even when William Hassett walked down through the train that morning to ask Eleanor Roosevelt if he could do anything for her, he found her staring out the window at the scenery, mesmerized by that river, by those tracks, as happens when you take the Hudson line. It happened to me this afternoon. And at the stations, as it had been in the South, people had gathered. Sometimes it was a small crowd, sometimes a lot bigger. They were at every station along the route, and the Hudson line goes through a number of backyards. It did then, and it does still. And one of the members of Roosevelt's cabinet, I remember reading his diary, and he remarked how amazing it was to stare out the window of his Pullman car and see these women in their house coats who had tottered out into the dewy grass in the backyard so early in the morning just to stand there and wait for a glimpse of this train as it passed. North of Cold Spring, there was another man standing by the tracks. His name was Ed Nowak. He was the official photographer for the New York Central Railroad, and he had been dispatched to record the funeral train for posterity. And I'm not a photographer, but I can speculate on the pressure that that man was under on that particular morning, because he only had one chance to get a picture of this train. And he knew the line very well, so he knew where to stand. It was a few miles north of Cold Spring, and he got the Breakneck Ridge in the background, and it's where the track fans out into three, and it makes a gradual sweep, and it creates a beautiful panorama. And Nowak stood there with his camera and waited and waited. No one was sure exactly when the train would come. And then it showed up only going 25 miles an hour, but when you're trying to get 18 cars in a frame of a camera, that's pretty fast. And he only had one chance. And then the train showed, it came around the bend, the Hudson locomotive spewing these amazing cumulus puffs of white smoke and ash. And he clicked his shutter and he captured all 18 cars perfectly. And that is the photo that's on the cover of my book. When the train reached Hyde Park here, the second section that had the overflow people on it, that section was in the lead at that time. The two sections of the train actually took turns in the lead. That was part of the security measure as well. No one was entirely sure which train was which. And so the Congressional, as the second train was called, went on ahead, and it stopped at the Hyde Park Depot right down, I guess that would be behind me now. And it let off its passengers there, and then army cars took those people up the hill to the Rose Garden over here for the burial. Meanwhile, about 15, 20 minutes later, the funeral train proper pulled up at a private siding at the foot of this property. In 1916, the Roosevelt family had paid the New York Central Railroad a pretty penny to construct a private track that curved in from the main line, and the purpose of that was to give guests and, of course, the Roosevelts themselves a place to park their private Pullman cars when they needed to. And that was the siding on which the funeral train pulled. And the engineer jockeyed the train up just far enough to line up the last car with a temporary wooden platform that had been built the day before. And that was where the casket was taken off. And, of course, it was brought up the hill here. The original plan had been to bring it up the hill on a horse-drawn caisson. But somebody also figured out, much as Patterson had figured out down in Georgia, that it was a nice idea that wouldn't work too well because the hill was too steep and the horses could never get a 700-pound copper casket up a hill like that on the back of a caisson. And so the casket was put aboard an army hearse and brought most of the way up. And then there's a little meadow just below the big house here, and the hearse pulled off in there. They took the casket off, and then they put it on the gun carriage, and the horses drew it out of the woods and brought Roosevelt to the place in the garden, as he specified, where the sundial stands, and he was laid to rest there. I want to read you one more part from the book, and then I will not take any more time of you very, very patient people. I want to read a part that deals with the train passing through Garrison. At the elegant slate-roofed station in Garrison, New York, where the Hudson River lapped onto the stones just feet from the platform, some 80 locals had come at dawn on Sunday to wait in the cold for the funeral train to pass them. They had arrived in automobiles, some of them old Model A Fords, to which a few people returned now and then to fetch thermoses of coffee. Distinct from the motorists was a group of Capuchin Franciscan friars, their cassocks pulled tight to their waists with white ropes. The brothers had come on foot, sandals specifically, to the station from the Glencliff Monastery, 1 mile distant, whose Gothic turrets poked high over the trees on the hillside. The friars positioned themselves in a row of such precision it seemed better suited to West Point, the military academy whose gray granite ramparts rose directly across the river. While the Capuchins stood in complete silence, the people around them talked quietly about Roosevelt. "I hope he's not in one of those old-fashioned trains. It wouldn't be proper," said one. Another expressed a lament shared by countless thousands of other Americans. "I wish to God he'd managed to hang on until Germany was licked." A father in the group turned to his young son, who had been shivering in the cold, and spoke to him. "You've got to remember everything you see today," the man said, firmly but not unkindly. A watchman's shack stood some distance from the platform, and presently a teenager in a mackinaw with blue and white stripes made a beeline to it, meaning to inquire as to the funeral train's whereabouts. Moments later, a black engine hove into view to the south, a full head of steam driving its pistons silently in the distance. The rails registered a faint hiss that grew louder and louder until the train pounced. 11 cars thrummed past, the enormous heat of the locomotive giving way to the sucking tailwind of the passing Pullmans. "That's not it," the adolescent announced, having returned from the shack and flaunting the knowledge that the watchman had obviously shared with him. The lad continued, "The president's in the next one, in a car called the Roald Amundsen." Usage of the term president was still a confusing thing for Americans on this Sunday morning, 3 days after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Did it mean that new man from Missouri? Since Truman had been assigned to the Amundsen, he was the one to whom the teenager must have referred. For most, though, president still meant the deceased squire from Hyde Park, the town 29.4 miles up the line from the garrison platform. But of course, he was in the next train, too. Minutes later, another locomotive loomed in the distance, a cottony plume of white smoke trailing from its stack. There was no mistaking the identity of this train. And now everyone joined the Franciscans in their silence. Just before engine number 5283 reached the platform, men removed their hats. One by one, the Pullman swayed past like drunken giants, the train's enormous weight sending a tremor through the very earth beneath everyone's feet. There was no way to tell which dignitary was aboard which car, but it didn't matter. The reason for everyone's coming was to see the last one. A writer for the New Yorker, who was present in the crowd that morning, would become the lone journalist on the entire funeral train story to express any sense of aesthetic appreciation for the worn but noble Connaught. The magazine's sapient editorial voice pronounced it a beautiful lounge car at the end with its military guard of honor. In the early morning river light, the dark olive Pullman with its thicket of blossoms behind the windows was exactly that, beautiful, even if few thought of it in such a way. Then the lanterns on the Connaught's tail disappeared around the bend to the north, and the funeral train was gone. As the people shuffled back to their cars, the little boy, sufficiently thawed out and excited, looked up at his father. "I saw everything," he said. "That's good," the man answered. "Now make sure you remember it." That line was very much why I decided to spend 16 months of my life writing this book. I am unfortunately not old enough to have seen this train myself, but it was a pleasure to play some small role in creating something that would help it be remembered. And it is an equal pleasure to have spoken to all of you this evening. Thank you. I forgot I'm supposed to take questions. Forgive me. Does anybody have any? Sir?
You mentioned the train. Ferdinand Magellan is down in Florida?
Yes.
I was up down there. I read it a couple years ago. They found it below
Actually, yeah, that's quite a Byzantine story. The car beneath the Waldorf Astoria at that platform is actually an old freight car, and the Waldorf uses it to store spare china and silverware aboard. There's been much speculation as to whether that car was part of Roosevelt's train. What we know is that that secret platform was used by Roosevelt one time. It was after he delivered a speech in New York, and he took the private elevator down through the hotel to that platform, and the Ferdinand Magellan was waiting for him down there, and he took the train from there up here to Hyde Park. The Ferdinand Magellan was given to Harry Truman for his use, and he actually logged more miles in the car than Roosevelt had. He loved it. But Eisenhower did not. Eisenhower referred to the Magellan as that old ark, and he refused to use it. The First Lady used it once. I believe it was to attend the dedication of the Nautilus up in Connecticut. But believe it or not, this amazing railroad car was declared government surplus a few years later, and it was sold for $1. An outfit down in Florida, which at that time was just a bunch of well-meaning college students, essentially, they were building a railroad museum down there, and they were able to acquire the car. And it is down there now, and you can see it, and it is absolutely, I wish last time I was in Miami I had been working on this because I missed my chance to see it, but do go. It's there, and it's the centerpiece of their museum. Anyone else? Sir?
Have you done any research on the Robert F. Kennedy funeral train? And how did that compare with the Franklin D. Roosevelt funeral train?
I only did a little bit of reading on it, in large part because as I was doing reconnaissance for this book, which the first thing that you have to do before you write a book is make sure nobody else has beat you to the topic. When I did a search on Amazon for funeral train and that book popped up, my heart stopped for a moment. But it wasn't FDR, it was RFK. There is a beautiful book of photographs of that train. It's literally called RFK Funeral Train. I believe it's out of print, and it's going for an awful lot of money on eBay at the moment. Given that that book came out, I decided not to do too much work on it. What I do know is that it did not travel anywhere close to the length that the FDR funeral train did. It basically went from New York City down to Washington. RFK had a service at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and then he was buried in Washington. So, you know, a few hundred miles compared to well over 1,000 for the JFK train. I do know one detail, though, that's interesting. I had mentioned the bier that Fred Patterson had built so the coffin could be elevated so people could see it. Incredibly, and this is actually a footnote in the book, the people that were planning RFK, and RFK obviously was not the president, but you know, people consider him very close to have been president. No provision had been made for a bier for his coffin. And so what they actually did is they put his coffin aboard a private Pullman car as well, but they actually had to get ordinary folding chairs and line them up facing each other, and they put the casket down on top of that. That much I know. Anyone else?
You mentioned a Russian spy.
Oh, yes. Yes, I unfortunately I couldn't, I just can't cover all the little twists and turns of this trip. There was indeed a spy on board the train, and his name turned up for me when I was able to obtain a copy of the passenger list, which that roster, of course, was a top secret document at one time. It of course, has since been declassified because they sent me a copy of it. And I might add that the unparalleled archive that exists here also has a copy of this roster. And as I was going down the list of names and trying to decide what rabbit holes I wanted to jump down with my research, because obviously I couldn't look for the writings of 140 different people. The name Lachlan Curry popped out at me because I had read something about him. And in fact, yes, he was an operative in the Silver Master spy ring in Washington. He was a rather, he worked in the West Wing, and he was an economist, and FDR had recruited him to help implement his New Deal programs in the 30s. And Curry became a very trusted member of Roosevelt's inner circle, and he was also what the Soviets called a fellow traveler, meaning he was willing to help by sharing information. And so this would all emerge later, after the funeral train made its run. A woman by the name of Elizabeth Bentley, who was quite a spy in her own right, turned herself into the FBI and started naming names, and Curry's was among them. So his story began to unravel. What's interesting is, as he rode the funeral train, his cover had not been blown yet. And so some people have expressed a degree of disappointment that I don't have a spy doing cloak and dagger stuff while he's riding the train. And the reason he didn't, folks, was that he was a spy. He was good at what he did. And what they did was made it their business not to be suspected. And so he was very quiet. He didn't turn up in any of the diaries that I found. But what I was able to discover later was that there was a project that the government government had called the Venona Project, and that was the U.S. government's effort to break the notorious double-encrypted Soviet code that was used to get intelligence out of the United States during the war. And it took them many, many years to break this code. But when they finally did, and they only deciphered a small percentage of the documents that went from Washington to Moscow, but Lachlan Curry's name turned up again and again. His code name was Page. It'll never be known the extent to which he did spy. What we do know for certain, though, is that one of the documents that he sent to Moscow, of course, encrypted and everything, one of the documents he was able to pilfer and turn over had to deal with the United States policy toward Poland. And, of course, as the war was winding down, Stalin had his eyes on Poland. He wanted to turn that into a Soviet satellite state. And at that time, FDR was adamant that that not happen. And so this was a huge point of contention. However, secretly, the United States had decided, Roosevelt's administration had decided, that it would be willing to give ground on Poland, although its public stance did not indicate that. Well, Curry was able to float that document to the Kremlin, and so Stalin knew that the United States was willing to give up Poland long before it did. And so that was the work of our spy who was on board. So, yes. Yes, in the back.
Was Eleanor with him when he died, or did she have to travel?
No, Eleanor was in Washington when FDR died. She was delivering an address at the Soulgrave Club in Washington, which was it was a kind of upper crusty ladies club in DuPont Circle, and Eleanor was she was attending a concert there, and I think they had asked her to say a few words. She, as many of you probably know, was very often not with FDR, especially when he traveled. She had a schedule of her own to keep. And so Roosevelt was down at Warm Springs with his entourage. And, of course, this is where our betrayed widow comes in. He was down there with Lucy Mercer Rutherford, who was his one-time paramour back during the First World War. She had come along with a painter friend of hers named Elizabeth Shumatov for the purpose of having FDR's portrait painted. And perhaps some of you have seen that. It's a very famous portrait. It's unfinished simply because FDR literally died while it was being painted. But no, Eleanor would receive word from Steve Early, who was the press secretary in Washington. He called the Soulgrave Club and said to her, come to the White House immediately. Later, Eleanor said that she knew, she had guessed instantly what had happened, and she rode in the limousine back to the White House, she said, with her fists clenched. And Steve Early informed Eleanor that FDR had died. And then, curiously, it fell to Eleanor to tell Harry Truman that FDR had died. Truman was summoned around the same time. And so it must have been amazing as a scene, because Eleanor had just found out, and then the usher let Harry Truman into the room, and she went up to him, and she gently laid her hand on his shoulder, and she said, Harry, the president's dead. And Truman at first could not summon words to speak, and finally, when he could, he said he was very sorry, and he asked if there was anything he could do for her. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, is there anything we can do for you? For you're the one in trouble now.
Was Sarah his mother alive at the time?
No, Sarah had died a few years earlier, and Sarah is buried across in the St. James Churchyard, I understand. Sarah controlled many things about Franklin and Eleanor's life, much to Eleanor's chagrin. Sarah does have a very, very small kind of after-the-fact influence on the proceedings, because when Roosevelt staffers down in Warm Springs were trying to determine what kind of casket to select for him, and they really weren't sure. I mean, they were completely caught unawares. One of them remembered that when Sarah had died, Roosevelt had picked out a bronze casket for her. And so when they called Fred Patterson, that was the first thing that they had asked for. They said, "Do you have anything in bronze?" Because they figured that they had nothing else to go on. And they thought perhaps Roosevelt would want the same kind of coffin he had chosen for his mother. So that's kind of where Sarah enters into the picture, if a bit after the fact.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Many people will remember Helen Fink, elderly woman, who passed away a few years ago. She was, I think, 106. And I was, I don't remember the detail that well. And I was speaking to her once, and I asked her if she knew President Roosevelt, because many people here in town knew him. It was very kind of casual from what I understand.
Yes, yes, very much so.
And her response was, "Well, no, I didn't know him very well, but I know his mother quite well."
Yes, Sarah's reputation extended well beyond the borders of Hyde Park. And she was quite an extraordinary woman. And she soaked up the role of being the president's mother absolutely to the fullest. And probably the best example of that is when royals came to visit, or frankly any important head of state, the practice for a time had been to put them up in the Vanderbilt mansion next door. But Sarah's opinion was that her house was just as good as that. So she must have been something. I would have liked to have met her. I don't think I would have liked to have answered to her. Thank you. Thank you very much.